It was the summer of 99. I was 7 years old, and me and my sister were voraciously opening up a package sent to us by our much older brother in Mexico City. The package was once a box of powder laundry detergent, and as we ripped away the brown wrapping paper, we could start to see the Ariel branding on the side of the box. Once we carved out the top, we took out the gray rectangular console with two controllers, a copy of Super Mario World and Super Metroid. After some adult assistance setting it up, we wasted no time trying to get it running. After a few alarming freeze frames and some needed shaking and blowing into the cartridge, the game was on. It would take us the entire summer to learn the basics of platforming, navigating while on Yoshi's back, and eventually, spoiler alert for an almost 35-year-old game, arriving at the last fight with Bowser as he hovered on top of a clown face blimp while we frantically jumped and tossed everything at Bowser while trying not to die. However, even the eternally long days of summer as a kid would not be sufficient for us to get good enough to beat Bowser. Add insult to injury, for whatever reason, most likely the battery inside the cartridge had died, therefore preventing us from being able to keep save files. So it would literally become our job to play through Super Mario World and not get a game over every time to see it through. The game was relentless at first, but despite the difficulty, we got good and would become seasoned speedrunners by the end of summer. That is until we were humbled by the Bowser and the mockingly jovial clown blimp that made sure we never saw end credits. This would remain true until a few years later, when I was recounting this difficulty to Fernando, the teen that spent his days helping his family out in my town's papeleria. That stationery store for my American listeners, although culturally much more. I kind of one-stop reference hub similar to a library, but not free and for a low price. His brother Jorge and I went to the same primary school in Rosarito. And so one day after school, my sister Jorge and I hiked down to the papeleria, and with my Super Nintendo stuffed inside my backpack, we found ourselves a space inside the workroom and hooked up the SNES to a TV that would otherwise be playing telenovelas this time after school. Was to beat the boss that evening, we were now attracting a crowd of other neighborhood kids. The time to beat basic stages became stretched out by trying to delegate who would get the remote passed to next. Listener, the truth is I never got to see the end credits of that game. But what if defeating Bowser was really the friends we made along the way? Bringing over the SNES to the papeleria, my friend Jorge's house, and several cousin birthdays became a tradition. That hand-me-down Super Nintendo from my brother occupied many weekends, spring breaks, and summer days that brought what would seem as an endless free time only afforded to the POV of a youth in the late 90s growing up in Rosarito Beach. Then came the summer of 2000, when my brother David from Mexico City came to stay with us for a few weeks, and with him, he brought a Nintendo 64. After an evening of pleasantries, sharing stories, and dinner, we snuck out to set up the console in the living room. With him, he brought a copy of Ocarina of Time. I watched in awe as a dark green field became illuminated by a large moon, slowly descending down as a brown horse with white mane galloped through Hyrule fields. The next few days, I would watch my brother play through the entirety of Ocarina of Time. The way he played suggested a mastery of the game, as he flew through each of the puzzles and dungeons. He must have beaten the game a dozen times prior to this playthrough. I was captivated by the lore and murkiness of the world. Even early on with the sanguine musical theme of the Kokiri, There was a gloomy and dark presence seeping through the seams of the small forest town inhabited by the young Kokiri. This melancholy would only grow further as a young elfish boy on the bulbous CRTV screen fought monsters as he navigated the dark and dreary path deep inside the great Deku Tree, a dying guardian spirit of the forest. Even as a young hero killed the giant one-eyed spider Goma, and its body became engulfed in blue flames, quickly vanishing to dark dust particles, the growing feeling of sadness lingered when he met back up with a great guardian spirit. As a kid, I was shaken when Link and Navi said goodbye to the Deku Tree, as he rotted away into darkness. Confronted by a few of the Kokiri, I couldn't help but feel guilt for what the young hero had done. As he sped through the forest, arriving at the bridge connecting the town to the outside world, Saria would reappear with absolute sadness in her face as she confronted Link and admitted she knew this day would come. As she hands Link the ocarina, Saria also says, "Because we will be friends forever, won't we?" And without a response, Link starts backing up slowly to then turn and start running, not looking back. I was so upset by this that I got up from the living room and went to the kitchen to pour myself a large bowl of cereal and eat it in silence alone in the kitchen. The next day, I woke up with a fever, and I remember this distinctly because I was watching my brother play the rest of the game while I dozed in and out of sleep from the couch as he laid on the floor playing the game. I remember dozing off through most of Death Mountain and Zoro's Domain, waking up at pivotal story moments like Darunia's dance, the meeting with the young princess of Hyrule, and of course the climactic boss battles at the end of each of the puzzle-filled dungeons needed to collect the 3 sacred gems across the different territories of Hyrule. With the Kokiri Emerald, Korin's Ruby, and Sora's Sapphire in hand, all collected within the span of a day, young Link marched across the green pastures of Hyrule to meet with the princess once more. However, as we got close to the castle, my brother stopped and saved, and said, "Things get a little more intense from this point onward, so it would be best to get some food before continuing." The market a mile away was still open for a few hours, so despite feeling sick, I was hungry enough to tag along with David. I layered up, and on our way, we went. The sun was starting to set as we made our way up the hill. Once there, we got some tortas, Mexican-style sandwiches, and my favorite tangerine-flavored drink, chaparritas. He'd pay since he was given some money to buy food while visiting us in Rosarito. Afterwards, we'd climb back up the hill and sit on a concrete slab on top of where we could see the beach and the town as the sun was going down. "When does his brother show up?" I asked. "Huh?" David answered back. "Link's brother. The guy that's in the game manual. The handsome one with the ear piercing." "Oh, just you wait. He shows up soon." I stared back at him, annoyed as I finished half my torta and washed it down with some orange drink. As we made our way back to the house, a group of dogs came running towards me as they saw us coming down the hill. My brother, probably thinking he would have to pull out his sword and shield, got in front of me and stood his ground. But I jumped back in front and squatted down. "It's okay. I know them all. They're the neighborhood dogs. They just want this." I lifted the bag with half sandwich, patted a few of the smaller ones on the head, and then threw the food up in the air. The pack all chased after and soon dug in. "Don't you have neighborhood dogs where you live?" I asked. "Not really. I mean, maybe we go out into the city, but not in my neighborhood," David answered. A few of them would often follow me on my walk to catch the bus for school, so I'd know them pretty well. My brother would look uncomfortable whenever I got super close to them, but I reminded him it was okay. Most of them have homes. They just like to wander out. As we got close to the house, we could see the neighbors had some form of Eurotechno playing mixed with cumbias and corridos, a typical summer night where I lived. The neighbor lady would often invite us whenever they had a party, but this time, I let them know I was getting over feeling sick, so I was just gonna stay home and play video games. Ay, mijo, I'll stop by and drop off some pozole in the morning. I'll get some rest. Don't be out so late. Back inside, I ran to the couch and wrapped myself in a blanket. My brother made himself comfortable on the floor once again and continued with his playthrough of Ocarina of Time. Link ran back to Hyrule Castle as the torches were lit up despite it still being light out. The sky soon darkened to a pitch black. Only the constant lightning would illuminate Hyrule. Rain started pouring down as the castle town bridge came down, allowing for a rapidly galloping horse carrying Zelda's guardian, Impa, and the princess herself. Almost trampling over Link, the young hero quickly jumped to the side and made way for the princess and her guardian, who were not likely to stop for him. At the sight of Link, Princess Zelda threw a blue ocarina out into the moat. As Link turned away from the fleeing horse, he is met with the villainous Ganondorf once more, calling back to the dream he had at the beginning of the game. The sinister Gerudo towering above Link, refusing to tell him in which direction the princess fled to, Ganondorf blasts the young hero and vanishes into the darkness. Once inside the castle town, people are understandably disheveled and unaware of what just happened, having just learned the Melody of Time from a vision sent to him by Princess Zelda. Young Link then heads to the temple with the ocarina he fished out of the moat, along with the three sacred gems. Dear listener, the first time I experienced the following sequence of events in the hero's journey are forever imprinted into my memory, along with the imagination of a young vision of me trying to fill the gaps and make sense of the story onward. The Temple of Time is where we say bye to young Link. As Navi guides you through the doors of time and up the platform where the Master Sword rests, you brace yourself. This whole time, I've just been watching from the couch as my brother played, but felt no less immersed. Young Link walked up to the Master Sword, and as he retrieved the sword, he is transported to the Chamber of Sages, where he meets Raru. To me, this was one of the most impactful scenes in the game, because instantly the game felt so much larger. Woken up by a celestial choir in a world of cascading light into a different body. Where had young Link gone, and who is this 90s era heartthrob? And what do you mean you've been preserved in this chamber for 7 years? And by doing what you thought you had to, you were supposed to, you let evil slip in and bring calamity onto the world, leaving it worse than when you started. The stress of being the Triforce hero. Back in the Chamber of Time, Raru gives you the first medallion and urges you to find the six other sages, soon sending you back to Hyrule to start on the second half of your journey. Next would come a very formative queer-coded scene that is what solidified my love for this game. Arriving back at the temple, of all places, Link feels a presence observing him from the shadows. Feeling uneasy, he draws his sword and shield. Out from the shadow comes a ninja from the Sheikah clan. The handsome stranger locks eyes with Link and introduces themselves. We now had two iconic heartthrobs competing for the prize of most 90s parted bangs. Sheik advises Link on where to start and in what order he should retrieve the medallions. Our silent protagonist turns back around and carries on with his quest to bring peace back to Hyrule. For the next day and a half, I was glued to the couch, watching my brother speed through each of the elemental dungeons across Hyrule. Each incrementally more difficult than the first, but all opened up with an iconic musical scene where Sheik appears from the shadows to teach Link a bop. The Minuet of Forest, Bolero of Fire, Serenade of Water, Requiem of Spirit, Nocturne of Shadow, and the Prelude of Light. After collecting the respective elemental medallions from Saria, Darunia, Princess Rudo, Impa, and Naboru, you are ready to meet with the final sage, waiting for you back at the Temple of Time. You play the Prelude of Light, and the Hero of Time is teleported back to the temple where you are met by Shake. One last time. Shake shares with you a legend passed down by the people of Shadows. It goes, "If you would seek the Sacred Triangle, listen well. The resting place of the Sacred Triangle, the Sacred Realm, is a mirror that reflects what is in the heart of one who enters it. If an evil heart, the realm will become full of evil. If pure, the realm will become paradise. The Triforce, the Sacred Triangle, it is a balance that weighs the three forces, power, wisdom, and courage. If the heart of the one who holds the Sacred Triangle has all three forces in balance, that one will gain the true force to govern all. But if that one heart is not in balance, the Triforce will separate into three parts, power, wisdom, and courage. Only one part will remain for the one who touches the Triforce, the part representing the force that one most believes in. If that one seeks the true force, that one must acquire the lost two parts. Those two parts will be held within other chosen by destiny, who will bear the Triforce mark on the backs of their hands. 7 years ago, Ganondorf, the King of Thieves, used the door you opened in the Temple of Time and entered the Sacred Realm. But when he laid his hands on the Triforce, the legend came true. The Triforce separated into three parts. Only the Triforce of Power remained in Ganondorf's hand. The strength of the Triforce of Power enabled him to become a mighty evil king, but his dark ambitions were not satisfied. To gain complete mastery of the world, Ganondorf started looking for those chosen by destiny to hold the other Triforce parts. The one who holds the Triforce of Courage is you, Link, and the other who holds the Triforce of Wisdom is the seventh sage, who is destined to be the leader of them all. Inching closer and closer to the screen, me and my brother proceeded to see Sheik perform one of the most iconic hand motions as they prepared a seal, revealing the Triforce of Wisdom glowing brilliantly on their hand. The seal reveals Sheik's true form to be none other than Princess Zelda, the seventh sage and leader of the Sacred Sages. Now dressed in her royal Hyrulean dress, with long blonde hair and a crown of gold, she admits keeping her identity a secret to hide from the evil king Ganondorf. Instead of a song this time, she awards Link the Arrows of Light, which will help seal the darkness back into the depths and return balance to Hyrule. Soon, however, the temple begins to shake violently and she is trapped inside a glowing pink diamond, trapping her and commuting her back to the evil king's lair. As a young queer kid, these scenes held so much allegorical power, they would continue to live rent-free inside my memory for decades. Traversing to what was once Hyrule Castle, we now see a black industrial fortress hovering above lava. With the power of all six sages, Link creates a rainbow light bridge to enter his final dungeon. After revisiting each of the elemental sages for an encore set of challenges, Link climbs up a dramatic set of spiraling stairs to meet the Demon King. Entering the final chamber on top of the fortress, the sound of the organ intensifies. And as Link proceeds, it ceases. Ganondorf has been waiting for this moment. The dramatic candle-lit room with gothic stained glass windows as tall as Death Mountain became the stage for the confrontation with Ganondorf. Like expected, my brother, without missing a beat, danced as he parried each fireball launched by the Demon King until blasted him right back. Within minutes, we reached another cutscene indicating victory against the cave villain. As he struggled to breathe, the room was engulfed in darkness, with just the green of his skin and bright orange eyes radiating while he attempted his last trick. Burning down the walls and shaking ground until the black clouds and sepia-toned sky were visible. Descending from the sky in a pink orb, like Glinda from The Wizard of Oz, came Zelda. Brief was the celebratory reunion as the oppressive timer began counting down as the fortress started to crumble. I'd shake my brother in solidarity, telling him he had this, and as he battled waves of monsters with Zelda close behind. Coming down the eternally long network of stairs and corridors until within seconds to spare, he made it to the next cutscene, where the fortress completely collapsed to a flattened arena. "It's over! It's finally over," the Triforce heroes exclaimed. However, Navi circled them in anticipation of what could come next. Link ran to check the rubble, just to be the one enclosed this time by a ring of fire. Looking back, Princess Zelda gasped as an even more frightful version of Ganondorf blasted from the rubble. Deeply struggling for air, he used his remaining energy to raise his hand and demonstrate the shining Triforce shard before transforming into his final form, the colossal horned beast, Ganon. Swinging his large sword and flinging Link's master sword out of reach, the Demon King proceeded to pound mercilessly at the Hero of Time. With only the arrow of light, Link shot each one at the boar's head, stunning him paralyzed and going in for the tail. Eventually, the beast would collapse in agony, and Zelda would call out to him to give him a chance at retrieving the Master Sword to land the last blow on the Demon King. Shining with a brilliance gifted by the sages, the sword pierces the beast one final time right between the eyes, sending it into its last bout of screeches. It was then that the leader of the sages called out to them and ordered them to seal the Demon King. In a wonderful choreographed cadence, the sages each raised their arm once more, transformed into elemental energy, sealing the beast in the realm of darkness. I thought back to my endless attempts at defeating Bowser on top of that clown face blimp. And while I didn't beat the game myself, I rejoice in seeing an end to such a captivating odyssey. The hero's journey ended with a roaring celebration held across the kingdom of Hyrule. The end credits were everything I'd ever hoped for them to be, and on the Nintendo 64, with its then groundbreaking graphics. Days later, my brother would get packed up and ready to be driven to the airport as summer came to an end. He'd take his Nintendo 64 with him, no doubt, but the following summer, a box would come in the mail resembling the powder detergent container we got a few years back. Once again, I voraciously opened it, and inside, I found a translucent purple controller and the Nintendo 64 console, along with a scuffed-up copy of The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, with a note that read, "I hope you remember how to beat the game and get through it on your own." After playing this game to completion a dozen times that year, I would revisit it every year with a full playthrough, something that I hope to do for years to come. Thank you for listening to part one of my throwback retrospective of The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Tune in for part two, and as always, thank you for listening to Orcs in the Basement. Don't forget to follow on Blue Sky at orcsinthebasement.bsky.social and Instagram at orcsinthebasepod. Nos vemos.